And now, this is a special presentation of TBK Live and TheBuzzKillMagazine.com. Gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of TBK Live. We are covering the Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo coming to the Paragould Community Center this weekend. That's right, July 9th and 10th. And today, joining us is a former editor at Marvel. He now works as a professor at Full Sail University teaching creative writing. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show, Mr. Roland Mann. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. Let's give them 90, by the way, everyone listening, 90s kids, this is your show. Hands down, if you're a 90s kid, you're going to enjoy this, especially if you read comics in the 90s, kids. So let's start with your past. What got you into comic books?
Well, I always wanted to do comics. Comics are what actually taught me to read. And once I got into high school, you know, a lot of my friends stopped reading. I just never stopped reading. It was just one of those things. It's like I enjoyed them. I liked the storylines. I liked the art. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, and I just knew that I wanted to write. But my problem is, you know, I think we talked a little bit off the air. You know, I come from a family of farmers. Basically, they've been farming for as long as we know. And the only thing I knew, my dad said, "You're going to college." Well, I wanted to write, and his question was always, "How are you going to make money?" Well, I couldn't answer that because I didn't know. It's like, how are you going to make money? Well, I don't know, Dad. I just know that this is what I want to do. And so when I went to college, because I didn't know, I took 2 years of computer science. You know, this was back in the 80s, and so computer science was still kind of a big thing then. My problem was 2 years into the program, I was like, man, I cannot stand this math, right? It's so much math, because this is when you were having to learn Fortran and Pascal and RPG and RPG. Yeah, RPG.
I have not heard these terms in forever. Really? In a long time.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not like C++ or Basic or anything like that, you know? The math was just killing me. And so 2.5 years into my college, I'm like, you know what? I still don't have any idea how I'm going to make money, but writing is what I want to do. And so I shifted, changed my degree to creative writing. And I was very fortunate. My junior, senior years, I started sending out stuff to Marvel and DC. I was just sending submissions right and left. I got a stack of rejections. And when I was a senior, I met a couple of artists at the college. I went to Southern Mississippi. Excuse me. And I met a couple of artists, and he had a stack of rejections about equal to mine. And so we just started talking, and we just said, well, look, why don't we do our own thing? Because, you know, this, you got to remember, this was right after Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
So 1987-ish?
Yeah, I graduated from college. I probably shouldn't say this, but I graduated from college in 1989.
Okay.
So, yes, it was right in those, you know, all the stuff, all the independents were real new then. And so we just said, look, let's do our own thing. All right. I graduated in 88. Sorry. Yeah. 89 was when I made my first sale. And so I hadn't graduated, and then boom, I made a sale. And so, but we just said, look, let's do our own thing. And so we did, we put together a comic, but then we were kind of like, a little bit like I was telling you about Image a little bit. We had our comic, but we didn't know what to do. So we shopped it around. Long story short, we ended up with Malibu Comics, who ended up buying the series. It ran for a couple of years, and Steven then is the guy I was talking to. Steven went on to do Silver Sable and Spider-Man and the Badger, and then I went on to do a bunch of other independent comics as well before becoming an editor.
Okay, so I'm going to ask, because I feel like it's probably out there somewhere, what was the first comic book you sold?
First comic book I sold was Cat and Mouse #1.
Okay, so do you remember anything about the story?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I caught you off guard with that one.
No, yeah. I proposed to my now wife in the comic.
That's awesome. Yep. By the way.
So if you ever talk to her, you'll hear her kind of complain. Yeah, we dated for 7 years. Well, part of the reason is she puts so much pressure on me. She's like, yeah, I don't want you to just propose to me like at a restaurant in a normal way. And I'm like, well, crap. What am I going to do now? So, I'm like, okay, do I get a big Jumbotron? I mean, what? So she was like, I had to propose to her in a very special way. And so I had already decided a couple years before that, okay, this is what I'm going to do. In my first ever printed comic, published comic, I'm going to propose to her. Well, now here's the weird thing. I sold the book earlier, and it was supposed to have come out in 1988. So it's supposed to have come out a full year before when it did. So I was supposed to have proposed to her.
1988.
In 1988, right. And who knows, we might have been married in 89 instead of 90, which is the year I was married. But yeah, the reason I remember that one so well is that's one reason, of course. But now Cat and Mouse ran for 2 years. And it was optioned by Hollywood. So I got Hollywood money from it. Now, it never went anywhere. But
with all the comic book movies happening, it still may go somewhere at some point.
So let me tell you, you're not quite getting an exclusive, but you're getting a near exclusive. I'm actually working to bring Cat and Mouse back.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
So I'm very excited about that.
And now I've got to go find this. At some point,
it should be pretty easy to find in your dollar boxes.
I don't think it's in Chris's dollar box yet, but
the first couple issues are like 1 through 4 are more difficult to find, but 5 through 18 should be.
I feel like anyone who proposes to their wife, that should be just an issue. That's just a magic. Like, that's a special now. Like, that one should be almost on the wall, I feel, at your house. Is it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, my aunt actually took the cover of the first issue and blew it up. Oh, I don't know, poster size.
Oh, that's really awesome.
So, yeah, it's hanging on my wall.
That's really awesome. So what work did you do at Malibu?
So I was I began there as a freelance writer. They were buying a lot of the stories I was doing. They bought stories Demon's Tales. I did Planet of the Apes for them. I did BattleTech for them.
Which, by the way, is actually sitting right in front of us, which I never thought we'd ever find, but that's really awesome.
But after a couple of years, I've noticed that I was getting a little bit less freelance work from them as a writer. And so Atlanta Dragon Con 1 year, I just asked the editor-in-chief. I said, look, I know you guys haven't been throwing quite as much work my way as, of course, you know how creators are. I'm all paranoid.
Right. No, I get that.
Does my work stink now? And he's like, oh, no. We love your work and all this. And I said, so what's the deal? He said, well, we're actually going to try to shift to we want to copy kind of the Marvel bullpen model. And we want to try to kind of build a bullpen. We want to get some artists and staff. We want to get some writers and staff and that kind of stuff. And of course, I'm sitting there seeing all of my work. Malibu was publishing at the time about 60% of my freelance work. So I'm seeing like half of my work go away. I'm like, crap, what am I going to do now? And so just kind of off the cuff, I said, well, why don't you hire me? And he said, and he knows how Southern I am. So he said, you would leave your beloved Southland and come to California to be a comic book editor? And I said, well, you're telling me that I may not be getting any work. Or I could come be an editor. Sure, I would consider it. I'm not saying yes, but I'd say I would consider it. 2 weeks later, he called me from California and made me an offer. And made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And so,
so how was the California weather after moving and leaving here?
Listen, that's the one thing about California I'll say that is so nice. There's never bad weather in California.
No joke.
Never bad weather.
I always enjoyed going down the 101 between Los Angeles outside Los Angeles and the mountains on one side and the ocean on the other. Just, oh.
It's the perpetual roll your windows downstairs.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah?
I mean,
Oh, that should be their new catchphrase. I feel like you need to market that and sell that to him. We are the roll your windows downstate.
Let me write that down.
California, the rights go to Rolling Man. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, so back to more.
That's right.
Back to the. Malibu yeah. offered you and the editorship to come out to California. So you took the job.
I took the job, moved out there in 92 and started editing the what we called at the time the Protectors line of comics. So I edited the X-Mutants, Dinosaurs for Hire, which a lot of people know, edited Protectors. And within the Protectors family, there was the Ferret, there was Man of War, and Gravestone. So, and those were all, there was the Protectors were based off public domain characters from the 1940s. Ari Jones, who was the primary writer of that, just had taken and done all the research and says, look, let me bring these characters, because no one owns them, so let me bring them back. And that they became the Protectors. And that was with the Protectors then until the Ultraverse was launched.
Right. Well, let's move into that as well.
Well, okay, so...
The Ultra... Okay, so we're... I'm really... that whole thing has got me so flustered. I'm just like, whoa, wait a minute. So the Ultraverse, would that be the big step for Malibu? Would be...
You know, probably Image was the bigger step for Malibu just before that.
Okay, let's get into that.
Okay, so the Image thing is that a lot of people think that Malibu owned Image, but that's not the case. What happened is the seven Image founders at the time, they were the rock stars at Marvel and DC. I mean, they really were. They're the rock star artists. And so when they jumped ship, essentially they knew how to do a book. They're like, well, look, we know how to do all this stuff. It's just that once we get it done, we don't know what to do with it, right? And so they already had a working relationship with Dave Olbrich, who was the publisher of Malibu, right? There were four primaries at Malibu. Dave Olbrich was the publisher. Scott Rosenberg was the president. Chris Ulm was the editor-in-chief. And Tom Mason was the creative director. Those were the four primaries. And I really always considered all of them kind of my bosses, but right. even though I answered directly to Chris. But they already had a working relationship with Dave Olbrich. And so when Dave got wind of this, he's like, look, we've got the structure here. Why don't you guys just do the books? We'll shuffle them through. We'll solicit them. We'll handle the accounting. We'll handle the printing. We'll handle all that stuff and give you guys time to hire your own staff. And so that's what happened. So all the Image books initially came through Malibu. I think the official legal term for it is we were the publisher of record. So we weren't really the publisher, but
so
we
you
were
didn't have the right. I mean, you didn't have the rights to anything, but you were correct. Able to market it for them almost.
Yes, right.
So it'd be almost like self-publishing now if you go through Amazon.
Yes,
I get. I'm trying to like so that people at home know. So if you self-publish, you can actually get your books at Amazon in the Amazon marketplace. It'd be the same equivalent of doing that or through Barnes & Noble because you can do that as well if you self-publish.
Yeah, or Kindle, the Kindle Unlimited thing.
Yeah, it'd be the same equivalent of just doing all your own work. You're doing the grunt work kind of with them doing all the...
Yes, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah, and Malibu just handled is basically all the paperwork, all the kind of the non-creative stuff. And then this gave Image the chance to hire their own publisher and you know accountants and that kind of thing to get them into a staff. And I want to say I don't remember the exact amount of time, but it was about a year, 10 months, something like that. And then when they did, essentially, then you know all the Image books left the house. But here's what it did for Malibu. A lot of people say, oh, well, that gave you the money. You know, I'm sure there was an – I wasn't in accounting, so I can't say. I'm sure there was an influx of cash, some, but Malibu didn't own that stuff. The Image got the bulk of the money. But what it did was it put Malibu on the radar. Suddenly, it's like, oh, Malibu is this company that did all the Image stuff, right? So people suddenly knew who Malibu was, and so Malibu said, okay, you know what? Now we're doing the Ultraverse. And so they were able to – we were able to – basically sponge off of all the publicity that we got from the Image and then launch the Ultraverse. And then the Ultraverse then became our big thing.
Which is not the worst way in the world to do things. I mean, it sucks probably in the grand scheme now.
That Image is around in
Malibu. Yeah. I mean, I hate to go that far, but I mean, I think it would have been more successful. Did you guys take any credit at all, though? I mean, were you even mentioned in the books?
In the Image books?
Yeah, was Malibu ever mentioned in the Image books at all?
Matter of fact, I think if you open, you know, like I said, like the first year's worth of Image books, if you look at the publishing credits, I don't know if they'd be listed in the indicia or – but somewhere, I think, if you, you know, just open up the first page and maybe on the inside front cover or on the in the legal text at the bottom of page one, you should find a lot of Malibu stuff there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, this is something I didn't know. I didn't know that – and then technically you guys were this – and I hate to – this is a bad pun – spawn of things coming.
Yeah.
That's a horrible dad joke. Oh, my gosh.
It's all because Dave Olbrich already knew a couple of the creators and – so when they, you know, when they're the ones that said, hey, we want to do this, you know, because they were feeling that they weren't being treated fairly.
Right.
Well, Dave Oberst just said, hey, look, you know, you guys want to do this, we can take care of you.
Okay, so the Ultraverse. Let's move on to that. Okay, so what is in the Ultraverse?
Part of what the Ultraverse was driven, you know, Image was all about Image. If you ever saw any of their ads, it was, you know, it was all about Image, and you know, there was a lot to be laughed at when Image was first published because they were pretty books, but boy, they just their storytelling lacked a lot, right? And so part of what Malibu was able to do, what the Ultraverse was able to do, is come back and say, we're launching a universe built by writers. And we did that. We basically said our universe is built by writers. And so we were able to sort of be the, not the anti-Image, because we weren't anti-Image at all. It's not that, but we were sort of the opposite Image, right? Instead of being all about Image, we were about substance.
So it's like the alternative for the people who love to read.
Yes,
love,
exactly.
Love the actual story arc, not just the artwork that's with the books.
Right. This is the Ultraverse was stories for people who like stories and not just pretty pictures.
Which sometimes it's hard to find.
Quite like that,
but I get what you're saying. Sometimes, because when I first started getting into comics, and I get this is like all I cared about was like the covers and images, and then I started reading and going, some of these stories are fantastic.
Yep.
What is wrong with me?
That's right. Yeah. Why did I just leave this in a bag?
Yeah. Oh, I've done that so many times. Like I just and then I pick it up later.
You're one of those people.
Yeah. Years later, I'll read it and I'm going, I should have read this when I bought it. What is wrong with me? No, what were some of the major titles that came with the
Ultraverse? Okay, so some of the big titles that people probably know the Ultraverse from, Prime, that was probably our number one title. Prime, Mantra, The Strangers, Ultra Force, which had George Perez art for...
I have seen Ultra Force floating around in there.
Well, that's certainly one of the big ones. Ultra Force even had a cartoon.
I remember the cartoon, I think.
Had one season, maybe two. At least one. I can't remember exactly. Nightman, which was a book that I edited. Nightman had a television show. One of these late night TNT TV shows.
Yep.
Sludge, Prototype, Freaks, Exiles. Those were...
I think I have Freaks. I have Freaks in my collection, honestly.
I edited like the last couple of issues of Freaks. Just the very last few issues, but... Yeah, like, you know, I always tell anybody, if you've got any Ultraverse titles at all, there's about a 50-50 chance that I was the editor. I didn't start off editing the Ultraverse because I was editing the Protectors.
Right.
But ultimately what happened is the Ultraverse was launched and the company decided Protectors is kind of in direct competition with the Ultraverse, so let's, you know, phase out the Protectors, move me over into the Ultraverse. Dan Danko was an editor at one point in time. Chris Ulm started off, I think I mentioned he was editing Rune. And then once I kind of worked over, Dan had gone over to Special Projects and Ulm had kind of taken more of the editor-in-chief roles. And so basically it was Hank Knaltz and me, and we were kind of the you know, like I said, it's about a 50-50 shot.
So at this point you're editing. Is the itch to get back into writing there?
It is, very much so.
I figured I'd ask that, because I figured as a writer, you're just editing. I feel like that's probably just like, I really want to get back into creating my own stuff.
And that was actually a small bone of contention between me and my bosses. Because, you know, I already mentioned I was, you know, in at Dragon Con talking to him about editing. Well, one of the things I talked to him about was that if I'm on staff, if I'm there, I'm more likely to get some writing gigs than if I were a freelancer. And my problem was just in that, you know, and I did some stuff, but my problem was in that period of time, I didn't feel like I was getting enough. And so, yes, I very much had the itch to get back into writing. And in fact, probably about 6 months before Marvel shut everything down, I'd already started talking with my wife. My daughter had been born out there. And I'd already been talking with my wife. You know, this is not really what... You know, I'm not getting to write. My life's goal was, I wasn't in college saying, man, I'd really like to be a comic book editor. That's what I want to be when I grow up. No, I wanted to be a writer. And so we had already been talking about moving back, and she works in academics. And So she had already interviewed for a job or two. Nothing that really we didn't. Yeah, that's it. We weren't in a hurry. You know, it was kind of thing. When the right thing comes up, we'll go. And then when Marvel fired everybody, that kind of sped things along. We're like, okay, I guess we need to go.
So I guess we probably should Marvel bought.
Marvel, yeah, sorry. Ultraverse was incredibly popular. And, you know, everything is a lot of people don't like to acknowledge this, but really in comics, it's all about the money. I mean, when you talk about Marvel and DC, it's about the money. It's about market share. The publishers are very aware of how big their market share is. And Marvel's pretty much the dominating factor. What a lot of people don't realize is that DC was very close to buying Malibu Comics. They'd been doing due diligence for like 6 months, right? They'd been looking into the records. And I knew about this, right? This is one of the things that I was aware of as one of the senior editors. It's like, yeah, DC's here. They're poking around. They're looking around. But what happened was, and don't hold me to the exact market share. Now, anyone can find this.
It's public record.
It is public record. But roughly, Marvel had like 40%. DC had about 30%. We had about 12 to 15%. So if DC had purchased us, that would put us just above Marvel. It would put DC just above Marvel with our combined market share. Guess who was having none of that?
Marvel.
Marvel was having none of that. They caught wind of it. Literally, the guy who owns Revlon, what's his name? Help. This is financial circles I don't walk in.
Hey, you're fine.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. The guy who owns Revlon. Anyway. They got caught wind of that, right? He jumped on a plane, flew from New York to California, was in the Malibu Comics office that weekend, said, "What's DC offering you? I'll offer you twice." And they did no due diligence. But now again, they were Marvel was in a, you know, they'd gone public, so they were in a growth
phase. Was this
phase.
Before or after Disney has now acquired?
Oh, this is way before. This
okay,
way
so
before.
Let me make, I had to make sure so yeah, that yeah, people yeah. listening.
This yeah. is way before.
You have made a friend.
Marvel had just gone public. And their stock was doing really well. I mean, their stock, I want to say it opened up at around 20 bucks, something like maybe 15, grew to 50, split, dropped down to about 25 bucks, grew to 50 again, and split again, dropped down to about 40 and hung. Now, this, you know, over a span of time,
right.
Hung around 40. So Marvel was, you know, they bought Panini stickers, they bought Heroes World Distribution, they bought Malibu Comics, they bought several companies. And what they were able to do is they were able to go back to their shareholders and say, look, we're growing the empire, right? Well, a few years later, when the comic book industry crashed, they fired the guy who was in charge. I forget who that was. They fired the guy in charge. And you know what happens at a big corporation.
Oh, yeah.
What does he do?
It pretty much just goes, yeah. He's,
yeah, he's got to come in and say, okay, we're cutting this. We're cutting this. We're trimming the fat, right?
Oh, so I hate all that term. Yeah, we've heard that term.
You've heard it. That's what it
is. Numerous times.
Anybody who's worked in any kind of job like that has heard that, right? And this is exactly what happened. The new guy comes in, and he didn't have a vendetta against Malibu. I don't believe anyway. I mean, I just think he came in to say, look, you know, the last guy bought this, the company bought this company, bought this company. We're cutting them. We're getting rid of them. And that's how, you know, that's how they ended up killing the entire Malibu division. When Marvel purchased us, right, we became a division.
Right.
Essentially, we were the West Coast division of Marvel. Marvel still had the East Coast offices. We were the West Coast division in California there. The idea was that we were going to, you know, do all the Hollywood stuff. I will tell you one of my highlights, though. I have to say this. I have to brag on this.
Go for it.
After Marvel bought us, one of the things our EIC said that he wanted to happen, he said, we want a lunch with Stan Lee. And so Stan Lee agreed to eat lunch with the editors, and I sat as – yeah, I mean, I could move my left elbow and bump Stan Lee.
Oh, that's awesome.
And 3-hour lunch. And I don't even remember what we had, but Stan Lee just told stories the whole time.
And that guy can captivate a room.
It was just highlight. It's truly one of the highlights of my time there.
That's really awesome.
Editor, so.
Any big titles come through there for the Marvel fans? And did you guys get any of those come through since you were Marvel West Coast at that time?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because part of what happened is right after the purchase – Marvel editorial came up with a list of like C-tier characters that they just couldn't make sell, right? And you got to remember, this is before all the movies and everything.
Right.
And so they had a list of C-tier characters. Well, man, we went through those. And we're like, yes, 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 yes. Right? So they included, all right, you ready for this? They included Thor.
As a C-list character?
Thor was a C-lister at the time because they could not sell Thor.
Wow. Right?
It was just terrible.
That's really surprising to hear now.
Well, it is now because, I mean, look what he's doing in the movies.
Right.
They had Submariner, what was a C-lister.
Right.
Okay, I'm trying to think. Because of Thor, we actually did get Loki. So if you look at the Ultraverse titles, we got Loki. I was an editor for Loki in one of my stories.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Loki did some sort of time, you know, universe kind of thing, and he popped into the Ultraverse. We ended up not getting most of the characters that they said because they kind of said, yeah, no, we think we'll do this. We did get a couple. We did get Juggernaut. I edited the Exiles, and Juggernaut was part of the Exiles. We got Adam Warlock for a while, and Adam Warlock was in Rune, some of the issues that I edited in Rune. Obviously Loki. Oh, we got the Black Knight, who was an Avenger at the time, and he went to the Black Knight became one of Ultra Force members. I'm drawing a blank on him.
I'm still really surprised that Thor's a C-lister this time.
It was at the time, you know, and you're thinking.
I mean,
you
this
know,
is
93.
Yeah, this is the early 90s.
Yep.
Thor's still, you know, got the whole mythology thing going. It's come on.
I will say this. If you read any of those comics back then,
I don't think I've ever touched a Thor.
You would understand why it was a C-lister.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't say that in case those people hear it. But yeah, if you read any of them, it's really obvious. They just wasn't very
Times
good.
Have changed.
Yes.
Times have changed a lot. Let's move on. So now you're editing. Marvel's done.
Right.
Marvel has shut you down.
Right.
Where do you go from here?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I had built my entire life around this is what, you know, comics, this is what I was going to do.
Right.
We decided not to stay in California. We headed back. We were very lucky. My wife was offered a job at Mississippi State University. So we moved back to Starkville, Mississippi, which is, you know, not too far from here.
It is not.
And I decided because... I'm like, look, I've been an editor for, you know, almost 5 years. I kind of know how the other stuff is done now, right? Remember I told you when Cat and Mouse was launched, I had no idea what to do.
Right.
It was a little bit like Image in that I know how to make the book, but I don't know how to get it done.
Right.
Well, now I kind of had that. So from 96 to about 2000, I was a self-publisher. I say self-publisher. I was a small press publisher. I published some of my work, but I also published other titles. So the period of those few years, I published comics. But my problem was I was coming in at the wrong time. It was the crash, and I should have realized it. I should have been more business. I was not. I'll just say this. I'm a creative guy, right?
Right. And business is never the first thing you get.
I lost a lot of money in those 4 years. And my wife, bless her heart, she just kind of said, you know, if you can't find a way to at least break even, we need to do something else. And so in 2000, I just said, you know what? Because comics were selling terrible. Everybody was, not just me. It was
everybody.
Marvel had gone into bankruptcy, and you know,
wouldn't the crash really have just symbolized everything with the death of Superman?
Yes,
because I mean that's where I just
that's when you said there's something wrong with comics.
Yeah, when I put those two together, it's like everyone and their mother went out to buy the death of Superman. And I don't know if anybody knows how much those are worth now, but they're worth like $3.
Yes, because everyone has them. They printed. I used to know this, but I want to say it was 5 million copies of that book.
Right, and that's
why would
just
you think that's going to be worth anything?
And now and that pretty much to me is what I symbolize with the crash. Yeah. Like that was the killer.
And I think that was 97.
Yeah, it was 97, 98.
Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, it's one of the, you know, because I love comics, and so I just kept doing it for a while. And so it wasn't until 2000 to kind of catch us up to kind of where we are now. 2000, I just said, I'm done. I'm done with comics. They're no fun anymore. They don't sell anymore. I can't, you know. It's crap. And so I decided to go become a teacher. And I was going to be a history teacher because I love American history. Spent a couple of years working towards a degree. My wife got a job offer in Florence, Alabama that we could not refuse. And so I didn't finish. This is pre-internet days. Not pre-internet, but this was kind of pre-online.
Pre-before everyone has internet days.
Right, pre-online learning and all that kind of stuff. It was too far for me to finish my degree. And so we went ahead and moved to Florence, Alabama. I worked in advertising for a little bit. Ended up getting a graduate degree there at University of North Alabama. Started teaching English. I was teaching American Lit, freshman comp, that kind of, which I love writing. I love everything about writing. So I enjoyed teaching freshman comp. And that's kind of, for the most part, that's kind of what I've been doing since about 2003 after I earned my degree. I've been teaching.
So when did the itch get back into you to do a new comic book?
So in 2008, I was doing research for Huckleberry Finn. Huckleberry Finn was a book that I used in my English. It's one of my all-time favorites.
It's a great book.
It's one of my all-time favorites. And the internet had come along by then, and so I was, you know, it was one of the two books that I used in my my composition class. And I felt like my students weren't reading the book, that they were going online and getting all the stuff.
I can tell you they were probably doing that because I did that with a Scarlet Letter.
Well, so see, what I was doing, I'm like, okay, I need to find out what's easily available to them online. And so I was online searching for what's easy. I was trying to figure out what questions can I ask that they can't easily find online. I was trying to figure out what hard questions can I ask to make sure that they read the book. I stumbled across a publisher from India that was looking for someone to do a graphic novel adaptation of Huckleberry Finn. And I'm like, I'm done with comics. But that would be so much fun and so easy. So I just sent them all. I mean, I got to tell you, I was a little cocky here. I worked in comics. I was an editor, but I could do this, blah, blah, blah. And I really didn't expect to hear anything, you know, because I figured they would say, oh, we don't want to work with this. Look, this is a typical American attitude, right? They emailed me back, oh, we would love to have you do this. And I'm like, well, crap. And so they paid me well, and I did, you know, an 80-page graphic novel adaptation, and I'm like, that was fun. That was really fun. I had forgotten how much fun comics were. And so I emailed them and said, got anything else? And they said, well, yes, we do. And so I did an adaptation of The Wizard of Oz. Both of these will be available at the
Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo.
Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo.
I also am going to say the same thing I said on the last show that we recorded that's going up. I'm going to be broke after this weekend.
You know, if you're a comic book fan and you are not broke on Sunday night, there's something wrong.
I love, by the way, the fact that you're taking actual classic literature and turning it into graphic novels just makes part of me as a reader excited.
Yeah, well, I'm a reader. And part of me thinks that the reason that India did this is because, you know, they have a literacy problem in India.
Right.
And so I can honestly say, now, I've never seen it except for in pictures. I have work that's translated into Hindi. You can find copies of Huckleberry Finn and Wizard of Oz in the Hindi language.
That's just awesome.
Isn't that cool?
That is just awesome.
I've seen pictures of it. Now, I've never held a copy, but I've seen pictures of it because the publisher has posted, you know, pictures of their walls. And I'm like, oh, look, there's Huckleberry Finn. I can't read anything on it, but that's Huckleberry Finn.
That is awesome.
I know the art, right?
Oh.
So, yeah, it's actually very exciting. Wizard of Oz is obviously a real popular one, you know, because there's a lot of Wizard of Oz fans. And the artwork for that is just beautiful when you see it. So it has a tendency to do real well for me at shows. It was those two things that once I did them, I'm like, you know what? I remember why I loved comics. And so I just kind of started fishing around, seeing if I could find any artists who were interested in doing some projects. And one thing led to another. And I've actually started reprinting some of my older works that were miniseries that I still have the rights to. And so I would reprint them as a graphic novel. And so you can get those from me as a graphic novel. And I found that part of that is that, you know, no one wants to buy I shouldn't say no one. Few people really want to buy floppies anymore. You know, they want to buy the graphic novels.
Right. I prefer actually having the graphic novels.
And most people do. You know,
it doesn't lose its value as much. And plus, and it don't get hurt as bad. Because, you know, it's just, I get scared.
And you can put it on your bookshelf and you can read the spine. I mean, you know, a floppy, you've got to bag it and you got to board it. And you got to take care of it like that. And they're more easily torn. And so I have just found – I will have floppies with me tomorrow, but that's not really kind of what I push because again, nobody really, well, I can buy this $3 comic or I can buy this $15 graphic novel and I get the whole thing. But if I buy this $3 comic, I got to find issue number one first.
And right.
Maybe he's going to have two, three, and four, maybe. Or there's the graphic novel with the whole story. So I've had a lot of luck with the graphic novels, and so I'm glad that I've done that. And of course, then there's Tiny, which is what you said you saw.
Yeah, this, okay, so let's talk about that. That is your newest project,
right? It is, yep. Tiny is one of the things I started doing. Actually, I did it before I became an editor. If you look back at – I'll try not to make this too long. If you look back at my time as an editor, you'll see one of the things that I did and I enjoyed doing was finding new talent. So you'll see that there's a lot of people that I worked with that went on to do great things. Now, what does that say about me? I don't really know. But but there's any number of talented artists who still work in the industry today that I kind of found, right? Gave them some of their first paying work, that kind of thing. And so I enjoy finding new talents. Well, I won't tell the whole story, but long story short, my daughter met a girl at Disney and came back and said, "Dad, you should see this girl's artwork." And so I started looking at this and said, "Wow, this is pretty good. See if she's got anything else." Long story short, she showed me some of her artwork. I'm like, "This is really good. You ever thought about doing comics?" And she said, "No, but that would be fun." That's how Tiny was born. And she,
wow.
Yeah, I just asked her, I said, "Well, you want to do a comic?" She said, "Yes, I think that would be a lot of fun." And so we put Tiny together. She likes fairy tales, and so first time I've ever written a fairy tale. But I wanted, you know, part of my personal belief as a writer is that comic books is a collaboration, so it shouldn't just be about what I want to do.
Right.
It needs to be about what you want to. You know, if you want to draw My Little Pony, you're not going to be interested in BattleTech at all. you're just not.
Right.
You know, but if you love BattleTech, you're also probably not going to be interested in My Little Pony.
Or there's just like those few people out there who are me who's interested in both.
Battle Pony.
License to print money.
That's right. So I always try to find out what things my artist likes to draw, and then I try to pitch them stories that I think would have stuff that they like to draw. And she said fairy tales, and so I pitched her three fairy tales that I found that I thought were not quite the most common fairy tales, and she picked Tiny, which is the adaptation of Thumbelina. We made some changes, but it's recognizable if you're a fairy tale fan.
Which is just awesome how you're doing this, because that's something that not a lot of people do, and it's going to get more people into reading the classics.
I hope
as
so.
Well.
And it's all ages. I'm a big fan of all ages stuff. You know, part of what I think made Marvel and DC so successful was the Comics Code. Okay, we can talk about how good or bad it was at the time, but you know, the Comics Code sort of forced them to write within a set of rules, and those rules kind of changed over time.
Right.
It sort of forced them to write in a set of rules in which the work was accessible to all audiences. Now, the single hole in my argument is the Deadpool movie. It's one of those things. It's like, you know, you'd always argue, well, you know, the superhero movie should be PG-13 because this is a big, big audience.
That one just
blew all the explanation. You know, you can't explain.
Well, and The Crow was rated R as well.
But it didn't do what Deadpool.
No, it didn't.
The Crow movie's
amazing.
So don't mishear me. I think The Crow was a good movie, but it wasn't the financial success, right?
I think it's more of a financial success after it
yes,
was.
And
it's more now.
Omar
than it was.
A friend of mine,
right?
Because he was doing The Crow way back when I was doing Cat and Mouse,
right?
So this goes back to, you know, early independent days.
Which, did the independents go by the comic code?
No. The independents did not.
That's something I didn't know. I thought some did, and I didn't know if some would.
And do you know why the comic code existed?
I do not. I know a little bit of it, but not.
Because of newsstand distribution.
Okay.
So if you, in order to have your comics on the newsstand, you had to have the comics code. At the time, right? You had to have the comics code. Right? Because if you didn't have the comics code, the newsstand people go, "Oh, nope, this one's not safe to be distributed," so they wouldn't carry it. Well, independents came along and they didn't get newsstand distribution. They went direct to comic shops, so they didn't have to have the code. Well, in the late 80s, probably early 90s, we actually did multiple covers. We had a newsstand cover and a direct shop.
So the cover. Start of the variant cover almost.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So the newsstand had to have that barcode and the comics code. We had a barcode so you could scan it.
I was actually just talking about this because Spawn number one has a barcode where there's some spawns that don't, and the spawn with the barcode is worth more.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't explain all that.
But, yeah, no, it just was weird to me. I was like, why does it have a barcode and why is it worth more?
That's because it was on the newsstand.
See, I did not know that.
So what happened on the newsstand is that in comic shops, when they make the orders, they order them, they're stuck with them, right?
Right.
If you're a comic shop and you order 10 copies of a comic and you sell one, you're stuck with the other nine, right?
Right.
A newsstand distribution, what would happen is a printer would say print up like 100,000 copies, they'd send them all out, and then 6 months, 8 months later, they would get back ripped off covers.
Okay? Oh, wow.
And that now the newsstand people were supposed to destroy those, and then what they would do is they would get credit for the covers.
Okay.
So sell-through of newsstand books, now this is what's going to surprise you, sell-through of newsstand books were only somewhere between 15 and 20%.
So that's why they're worth more now.
You would print 100,000 copies, but you would only sell 15, 20,000 copies. And the other 80,000 copies would be destroyed.
I just see, this is, guys, you're all learning something new just as long as me. I would not let this interview end without doing something really quickly. Two questions. Number one, how do you feel about multiple titles in comic books?
I can't stand it.
Thank you.
I think if you're a Batman fan, you should buy one Batman book.
And it should just be the Batman story.
The Batman story. If you're now, I think there's one exception, right? I love Spider-Man. Spider-Man's one of my favorite characters. I think there should be one Spider-Man book, but the allowance would be you can have Spider-Man, but you can also have like Marvel Team-Up, which features Spider-Man and somebody else.
Or like the Avengers and that sort of thing. That's one thing.
If he's an Avenger, that's fine. He's in the team book, right? But Spider-Man should have one book.
Okay. How do you feel about all the multiple stories crossing books?
You mean like these massive crossovers? Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of that. I know why they do it. Having been an editor, I know why they do it. It's all about sales.
Right. Which is where the third and final question is going, I'm guessing.
Yeah, but
I think you know what I'm going to ask you.
What's that?
Captain America Hydra, how do you feel?
You know, it's
it has become a hot button issue on this show since this has happened for the last 2 months. Yeah, no, we get emails all the time.
So
every time someone's on the show, we have to ask
them. Here's the thing. As a patriotic American, the idea that Captain America is a Hydra agent makes my blood boil. The thing about it is, this is just a story.
Right.
They're going to tell their story, and then when it's all said and done, it's, you know, I don't know, it's going to be a dream, or it's going to be, oh no, he was actually a double secret double agent, right? No, he's not for Hyde. My thing is, I don't believe that for a moment. Like when you had told me, oh, they're killing Superman. Do you know what my response was?
No, they're not. Yeah, that's what I said. No, that's the only reason I never bought that.
Yeah.
By the way, it was just because he's going to come back alive in like 2 weeks.
Yeah, you tell me Captain America's a Hydra agent. I'm like, yeah, no, he's not. I mean, this is a story. I get it. They're generating a lot of hype. I don't know how many copies they're selling as a result
Have you seen the videos of them burning it?
No.
People are actually burning the comic. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, the first prints are being burnt by people.
Oh,
because
hold on to your copy, Ben.
Yeah, because
this is going to be worth something.
Well, and everyone, you know, we've had people on the show say it's just a marketing ploy. And I mean, we're all in agreement on that. But it's really funny to talk
about. It's an odd marketing ploy, I think, in today's sort of, you know,
I don't know any other
political sort of, I don't know.
The only other thing I can actually even compare it to, and I'm going to date myself, is Sergeant Slaughter turning bad and joining the Iraqi people in WWF in 1991 and spitting on G.I. Joe. That's pretty much the only thing I can compare it to.
I don't know. I think it's you know, it's a big deal, but I think it's all a big marketing ploy. So.
So you're going to have a booth this weekend at the Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo?
I am. I will be set up. I'm not sure what my booth number is.
I'm not even sure on that either.
I will be there, though. I will be there both days, all day long, Saturday and Sunday. I have a Q&A session on Sunday at noon. I think it lasts probably 50 minutes or something.
Yeah,
like
I think
that.
It's 45 to 50 minutes.
45 minutes. So I'll have so come and bring lots of anything that you didn't get answered during this session. Come and bring those questions, and I'll be happy to answer those.
Is there anywhere people can find you online?
Yes, they can find me at I'm on Facebook, obviously as Roland Mand Author, or you can find me at www.rolandmand.me. M-E.
.me.
.me. Yep.
That's the first .me I think we've ever had on the show.
I should have a blog that was about this the Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo that was released about 3 hours ago. So I blog about once a week. So
nice. So yeah. We'll throw this up with it, and it'll be great.
I was going to say, once I get the link for this, I will social media it all over.
I will send
place.
That to you as soon as this goes up this evening.
Cool.
Thank you for joining us, Roland.
Thank you so much for having me.
Guys, don't forget Friendly Neighborhood Comic Expo, Paragould, Arkansas. Tickets right now. You can get them at the door, or you can pick them up tomorrow night at the Paragould Cinema 8 when you watch Clerks with Brian O'Halloran. That's right. You can see Clerks with Dante himself. We will be selling tickets to the convention. It'll also be your last chance to pick up VIP passes. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheBuzzKillMagazine, and on Twitter at TheBuzzKillMag. Visit our store, shop.spreadshirt.com/TheBuzzKillMagazine, Zazzle.com/CravingHumor, and our Patreon account, patreon.com/TBKMag. And that's a mouthful to end the show. Roland, thank you for joining us, guys.
Thanks again.
We will see you later. I don't know. Have you ever seen the movie Manos, the Hands of Fate?
Which one?
Manos, the Hands of Fate.
No, I have not.
Where we end this show the same way. It's a character from this. It's the worst movie ever made.
Okay.
It's made with a camera that only films in 32-second intervals.
Oh, no.
It's been riffed by Mystery Science Theater numerous times. Torgo, you know how to end this show for us, buddy.
You cannot stay. The master would not approve.